We're really pleased to have Dawn with us from Colorado State University. Not her full bio, but a lot of the information about why she is extremely well qualified to come and talk to us this morning is up on our Ag and Uncertain Times webpage. Has a great deal of experience in the area that we've asked her to visit about, and in both the research and the extension side of this. And I've have the privilege of working with Dawn on a couple of projects. And so, Dawn, without further ado, I'm going to turn this to you, and the program's yours for the next 20 minutes or so.
Thanks for that gracious introduction, John. And I assume everyone can hear me okay, unless I see notes differently. But I am Dawn Thilmany, and I was very thankful to be asked to do this from the Ag and Uncertain Times team. It's always good to get a chance to get around and interact with professionals across the region and the country who are thinking hard about the same things we think about. And the challenge that was posed to me when I was asked to do this was to, in a fairly short amount of time, hit on some of the highlights of what I see as being the important principles and first steps and tools that producers would want to take as they try to both look for all the opportunities and potential and face some of the risks that they might face as they go out and do their operations. And to give due credit, most of these are not my original ideas, but lessons I've picked up watching the people who have done this successfully do it well, and trying to note with an academic eye what patterns I see about what is working and what's not working. So in the small amount of time we have here today, I'm going to try to hit on primarily three things. Even though it seems like a 10,000-foot level topic, strategic planning is a really important first step, and I'll try to motivate a little bit why, even though that sometimes feels not very action-oriented, it has helped a lot of really successful niche marketers have a clear, unified vision of what they're doing with their marketing plans from day one. Second, I want to spend a little bit of time talking about some things that are going on in the marketplace where people who maybe feel like niche markets aren't even something they can still go after individually, even if they are smaller markets than the larger, broader commodity markets. And so we've seen more and more activity around producers and organizations finding shared values and doing alliances. And finally, talk a little bit about cost-effective promotion. And really what this is about is connecting with your market and your customers and trying to become irreplaceable in their eyes, and some of what we're finding about the ways that people are doing that cost effectively. So we talked about this a little last week for those of you who joined the webinar series then, but just to make sure we're all on the same page, when I think of niche markets, I think of them as segments within the larger target audience. Especially if you're looking at a marketing perspective, it's about customers and how you can come up with well-defined customization of your product or service at a smaller scale to really more truly meet the needs of a set of consumers who seem to place value on that. So one of the first steps we've generally worked with producers on here as a research principle is to try to find ways to identify those customers and grouping them. And we started out as economists doing that a lot by demographics or maybe buying behavior, but more and more so with some of the belief that there's a growing consumer activism and people who are trying to vote with their dollars, also trying to find people who are motivated in similar ways. And then once you figure out how to group your customers, figuring out how to communicate with them so that they know you're meeting their needs or interests. So what we start with, again, even though it's at a 10,000-foot level, is making sure that the producers are doing really deliberate planning. And we can't talk about that in too much detail, but one thing I always encourage producers or producer organizations to do is to develop a mission statement, and that's basically a way for them to talk about what they're committed to. And part of that is because that mission statement is as important inside the organization as how you market to other people, because it makes sure everybody does have a unified vision of what their organization's about and what their values are and what they're committed to. Generally out of that, we try to start pulling some objectives about where they want to be, especially if they right now cannot meet all of what they want to be as they explain it in their mission statement. And so out of that generally follow some strategies, which are kind of our roadmaps on how they want to get to some of their goals. And in the area of niche marketing, generally the roadmap is about customer identification, possibly a little bit about coming up with the right pricing, but mostly about customer identification and how to find and connect with those customers. And so what then our goal for those of us who are trainers ourselves and providing the technical assistance is really our first step is to make sure they have their problem statement down to small enough statements that the actions that they can take are realistic steps they can take without getting overwhelmed, or that they can engage partners in helping them do, and it takes it from that 10,000 foot level of the mission statement down to an action plan. And three rules I found for niche markets off of entrepreneur.com are that you make sure you meet their unique needs, which is why we're going to talk a little bit about customer segmentation, that you say the right thing, which gets back to the having the right messages given by the right people in a credible way, and then they also recommend test marketing, and that's finding ways to start with very small, minimal capital investments before you invest, especially in irreversible investments in facilities and so forth. You test market first to find out where that is. And we can talk about this a little bit, but a lot of people would argue that that is part of why we've seen the boom in farmers markets across the country, is they have become the test markets and niche market incubators for many of the food systems in our country. Okay, so how do we identify niche markets? Like I said, we in the past, and if you even think of how media buys used to happen, it was bought by demographics. That is very much so switched in the last 20 years, so that now more and more of the identification of markets is by like-minded groups looking at their political actions, their lifestyle actions, their motivations, and other materials they read if you look at how the larger marketing industry is starting to group people. What we've tried to work with producers on doing here at Colorado State, and there's more and more literature out there so that many times you don't even have to do this yourself, is that you try to find ways to group people by their motivations. Many times it's by their preferences for production practices. Sometimes it's about their commitment to the place that they live. Sometimes it's about their commitment to the environment. But we usually find ways to group them either using kind of sophisticated research all the way down to just doing some simple little marketing research exercises wherever you do market, and then kind of almost branding those customers themselves and giving them a name. And I'll give you an example here in a bit of a study I did on natural meats with the Colorado Homestead Ranch Group. This clustering of customers does three really important things. First, it allows you to come up with kind of a potential market size, really what it is likely you actually could sell, depending on how broadly or narrowly you define the group you're going to try to go after. Second, it generally allows you to come up with way better marketing materials and marketing strategies, because you're not shooting for the average consumer anymore. You have a very clear vision about the people you're connecting with and what they want to know about you, hear from you, and have you give them assurances about. And then third, we also find it's generally fairly helpful with pricing as well, because we get a good idea of how strong their values are about things, and for that reason how much they're possibly willing to pay. So for the example that we have, one of the examples that we have done here at Colorado State was what we call a cluster analysis of natural meat customers for Colorado Homestead Ranches in western Colorado. They were very, very gracious to let us actually do a national survey, even though it was only for their market area, in exchange for our help. And what we actually really found at that point in time, although this is over 5 years old now, is that there were five clusters of different types of individuals out there. And as you can see from the percentages, that kind of maps out the market share we talked about before. We weren't overly rigorous about trying to figure out how that matched up to the total volumes of meat that they did, but we kind of just more broadly defined it. And although we're not giving you a lot of details here, we could identify a couple of those using a lot of different factors and measures to come up with who were the most likely to be customers of their business. And for instance, we found really that the quality seekers, who were 13% of the market, and the health and natural consumers, who were 13% of the market, were the most likely buyers. But even among those two target customer groups, they had very different reasons to want to buy. And so the marketing materials they developed, and actually even the market venues they probably found some of those customers at, were quite different. This is a little busier of a graph, but this shows how we use that same information in groupings to look at willingness to pay. And part of why we knew two of those groups were our most likely customers is because Homestead Ranches, to meet the goals they had for making returns to the producers, did have to charge above, at that time, what was the commodity price in the market. So if you can see the tallest bars for all four products, ground beef, ribeye steak, a beef stroganoff, and a chili verde value-added product they'd done, those were the two groups that we had identified also had like values to what they were doing with their operations. So we also used that for pricing, and those basically equated to 40 to 50% premiums they could charge above commodity prices if they chose to. And a final word on that. This was a fairly sophisticated national study, and I realize that is well beyond what most people can do with their niche marketers. But what we're finding more and more is people are doing creative things at the farmers markets they go to, the community-supported ag operations they're partnering with, or even the storefronts that they may be selling through, to find some of this exact same information through much more informal surveying or feedback mechanisms. And we'll talk about that a little bit at the end, but we can also certainly talk about that in questions. So this is one cartoon I found because I've given enough of these presentations that I also do believe that there is over-diversification that can happen and that we can get too far afield from our core mission to do anything well. So I do encourage that we think hard about how we change and diversify in smart and deliberate ways and not taking advantage of every change of wind we feel is out there with consumer preferences. So one thing I wanted to draw into, even though it seems somewhat far afield in niche markets, is what's going on with value-based food supply chains in the marketplace. Even though niche markets are considerably smaller, we still see a lot of producers who feel overwhelmed with the idea of changing their business model so significantly that all of their core competencies as a producer and traditional marketer are almost lost in the new marketplace. So what we've seen more and more activity around is people cooperatively coming together, not necessarily as cooperatives, but cooperatively in some business organizations, to team up with strategic partners who have skill sets they don't feel that they have, and rebuilding their supply chains and calling them value chains. And specifically, this is work out of the Ag of the Middle group. That is a new regional research committee that represents across the country. And their idea is that these supply chains are based on producers and businesses who have collaborative principles and treat each other very much as equals in the value chain and have commitments to fair returns to all members of the value chain. And for instance, some of the case studies they did in that project were natural country beef up in Oregon and shepherd's grain in the Northwest and Organic Valley, which is an organic producer supply chain across the country. And I guess I just want to bring that up because even one of the first groups we worked with, the Homestead ranches and beef example that I've been talking about was a collaborative of five producers who I'm pretty sure would has grown to even a few more people today, but would tell you none of them would have been able to do alone what they've done so well as a group. And so some of this is possibly us even as producers or technical assistants encouraging people to look for places where there can be collaborative efforts as well. And part of the challenge of working with groups trying to come together is making sure that you identify and build core competencies that they all believe in, they all believe are distinctive enough with their consumers that it sets them apart, and that they can do better than competitors, and that it's built on some core competency, we call it, that is something that's not very replaceable in the marketplace, so that it does have unique value that cannot be competed away. And we'll talk a lot today about examples that are production protocols, but those also can happen in the area of customer service, these unique alliances that do build stronger relationships with retailers, restaurants, institutional buyers, or unique resources such as heritage or a historical founding within your industry or region. So finally, I want to switch to getting your message out, and with the idea that it's not too useful to identify your niche market, identify the customers that are in that, or develop partnerships that allow you to bring that into different sizes of the marketplace if you don't have a good message and cost-effective way to connect with people. So I want to highlight a couple of things today, including something that is new to our state as well called Market Maker, but which is a national project going on, which started in Illinois and is now up to 18 states and is becoming one of the mechanisms that is being standardized across the country as a way to help people connect. And in a quick soundbite, it basically has portals where consumers can find their producers in different locations and different product categories. The producers can promote their operations and have a web presence, even if it's slight, if it's been too much for them to actually do that in a more targeted way. And quite honestly, we're also telling producers to use it as a way to do pretty free or cheap research, because they can immediately see how other people in their product categories are marketing themselves and actually use that as a way to emulate those who are doing a good job, maybe not even just in their state, but in the other states that are represented in this project. So just as a quick example, and I realize the font on this is small, this is what a search looks like in the Market Maker, where in the background, you can see a listing of all farmers markets in the state of Colorado, including some buttons you can hit to email those sites, go to their websites, or map the sites. And as an example, I did click on the web link to one of the specific farmers markets in the foreground, and it shows you that it's at most usually a two-step process for a consumer to find something they may be looking for in the local food system. And we're encouraging people who are in states that have this project to use this as a resource, because there's a lot of infrastructure there that would otherwise be very costly for the producer to do themselves. So we think of it as a cost-effective option. And as an example of where I've pointed people to look at where they can do market research, and just because I thought this was a clever example of the niche marketing I've been talking about, is this is a producer that I found using Market Maker, who did a really good job building up the value to his customers by everything that's being offered free at their farm. But it was also very savvy and giving some price points and giving comparisons to what the customer would pay for the same product at a local market. But all of that is after this particular person talked about everything that was free. So again, this isn't just the example of the farm I'm pointing out. It was the fact this was one thing I found just doing a really quick and light search on Market Maker, and it's what I've encouraged producers to do so they can find out what is going on in the marketplace besides them. Another thing that we took on this summer at the request of actually an agritourism project we're doing is looking a little bit at social marketing, which was a very new thing for me, but I've learned a lot in just the time I've worked on this project. But it's basically this viral marketing or networking, or for those of you who were at the risk management education meetings in spring, this tribal marketing that we're hearing about, where people don't want to hear very formal marketing messages anymore. They want to hear from their friends and people they trust what they're doing and enjoying. So we actually did an experiment on this with some producers here this summer. And the first thing we found, looking at just even the broader literature, is that of the current social marketing sites, Facebook is the most widely used across the broadest set of demographics and the stickiest, and by stickiest I mean people spend the most time there. In an experiment we did with three producers, including one control group where someone had a presence but did absolutely nothing on the Facebook site, is that there was a very, very nice payback for even the smallest amount of time spent on establishing a presence at Facebook, even if you didn't have another web presence. And so what the table basically quickly shows is that even for as little as 1/3 of an hour per week, up to 10% of the website traffic for a farm did come from other people getting the word out about this farm, it quickly growing a web presence. And then if you look at a bigger farm we have here that spent significantly more time and 5 hours a week, it drove a significant amount of their web traffic. And so even though this is very tentative results, I did want to point out that there's some evidence that tribal marketing does work, especially within local food systems, but what we have not been able to find any good evidence of is how it translates to sale. So we definitely think it develops a sense of community, but we don't feel like it's translating at least directly to sales. Through some couponing experiments we've done, that does not look like it's clear. So we feel it's an encouraging thing to do, especially to learn about your customers and what they're most interested in, but it isn't necessarily going to be the only thing you do to have a marketing strategy within your business. And finally, even though these are examples from Colorado, we do encourage all producers and all of you who work with producers to make sure you know about all the free listings and directories there are and make sure people get in them. They have become higher and higher used resources, at least in our state, and I think that's true in many of our states. So finally, one thing I usually end a lot of my presentations on is opportunity is missed by most people because it is dressed in overalls and looks like work. And what I tell people is there is no quick and easy way to develop your market and develop a relationship and community with your customers. It takes much thoughtful consideration. And it, even though we're talking about marketing here, behind that should always be discussions and concerns about what the financial implications are, what it means for your personal life, including a loss of privacy and autonomy, and that it honors the values you have about your way of participating in agriculture and the food community. And these are just 5 steps. Again, I ask people to revisit after they've decided the niche market they're going to go after. But I know I'm running out of time, so let's just summarize by saying that niche marketing is generally considered a growing segment of agribusiness strategies, but we still see that most people are only using it as one enterprise diversification strategy coupled with some other things they may want to do. And we only encourage it when it's tapping into an underutilized resource. It takes a lot of time. So when people come to us and say it's something they want to do, we usually try to help them identify, even though it will help create revenue streams, what resources are going to help them create those revenue streams. And if there are no Slack resources, make them think hard about whether it's possible and make them realize that it takes very different management and marketing skills and requires very careful consideration, because once you start personalizing your farm business and your products and need to have conversations with people face to face about what you represent, you need to make sure you as a producer have a solid grounding about what those answers are. And so with that, I'm happy to take questions, and I'm sorry if I went a little long.
This is Dwayne Griffith. For those of you attending, I'm in the background, and Some of the questions that we have is, if you have a single step you'd advise individuals who are marketing to niche markets take to protect themselves and share for that coming year, what is that single step?
What we have found is that it's all about making your business or your community you've built as irreplaceable as possible. So what I've seen the most successful people doing in the last couple of growing seasons successfully is having events and experiential opportunities that make people feel like they're part of the business family almost. And that has seemed to be a real significant indicator of whether customers become core customers that are very loyal and come back relative to some other operations who've treated it purely like a business and maybe only delivered on the contract there was for the community supported ag or the contract with the restaurant. Those people have had a little more trouble faring as even more producers have come into this direct marketing land. But really it's been about experiential. Even the natural country beef people make sure everyone who comes into their alliance realizes they're going to be spending time in stores, in the locations that have committed to them as retailers long ago, giving their customers the assurances and answers they want. So it's really about moving beyond the product to providing experiences and connections with the customer and consumer base so that it's much easier to think of it about think of any product or producer as interchangeable.
Okay, thank you. As we make the transition here to our next speaker, Raleigh, another question. Well, I'm going to ask you too. Could you provide the contact information for the market manager program, market maker program? Excuse me.
The only one I know is our state's, and that's all one word, ColoradoMarketMaker.com. But on any one state site, there is actually a graphic and a link for you to get to the National Market Maker site so that you can go to any state that's in the network.
Okay. And one more quick question here. Niche markets relative to what I would call or refer to as kind of the basic commodity markets. Do you have information on your past research that would indicate what the responsiveness is in those niche markets to price changes, you know, without using the term, the income elasticity in the economy, the demand elasticity in those kinds of markets?
Yeah, it's been kind of unique. What you see happening is not masking of the price changes, but generally some rebundling. So when I've had producers who've had to do some price changes to meet their return goals, a lot of times they'll do an offsetting change somewhere else in their plan. So, for instance, I know with the Homestead Beef example again, they were really troubled by the fact that they actually wanted some of their product to be cost-effective for some of their community members. So they actually knew they needed to hit some different goals. So I think they've done most of their price changing upward on their middle meat premium cuts because that seems to be among a consumer group that is way less affected by price, and I'm sure this year maybe that has changed. And at the same time then they did some larger value bundles or some products like ground meat that they could offer actually even at possibly a more affordable price so that there was always an option to tell people that if this is not affordable for you, we have some other options that maybe aren't your first choice but are just as affordable. And I think there's at least evidence in northern Colorado, this is why the community-supported agriculture movement has taken such hold, is that has become, for people who felt farmers markets were becoming too boutique, that has become the cost-effective way to get produce in this region, because for the volume you get and the assurance it gives to the producer for revenue, it is far more cost-effective than the average farmer's market basket. Plus, a lot of those CSAs have now added bundles from fruit growers, mushroom growers, cheese producers and so forth. So we actually see most of the affordability discussions happening with people transitioning from direct sales at farmers markets to the CSA models or buying clubs.
Thank you.
Thanks for your attention, everybody. I appreciated it.